I was first in Congress, I poo-pooed global warming or climate change because I thought that it was a figment of the imagination of some environmentalists. But then, in my second tour, I had the opportunity to serve on the Science Committee and hear a lot of evidence, and particularly to see the evidence in Antarctica of CO2 levels and the impact on our planet. And the result was I came to a very different conclusion, which is this is a serious matter that we should address. And if we play it right, we can turn this crisis, this danger, into opportunity. You know, as I understand it, the word crisis in Chinese is written with two characters. One means danger, the other means opportunity. And that's the way I view climate change. It is a danger. It's also an incredible opportunity for an innovative people.
What kind of reception did you get generally from your fellow Republicans in Congress when you talked this way about climate change?
Chilly. It's not warm. It's very chilly. Chilly reaction. Basically, the Republican orthodoxy at this moment is that climate change is not for real and we don't need to take any action. That's unfortunate because that's really not our heritage. The heritage of conservatives is more like Teddy Roosevelt, who are into conservation and who see a link between conservatism and conservation. So I think this is a temporary departure from that more long-standing belief that we should be about conservation. So hopefully it passes soon.
How did this play out for you? Remind us what happened in the Republican primary in South Carolina this year.
Oh, do we have to talk about that? Let's see. Well, yeah, it didn't turn out too well for me. Generally, there's a great deal of frustration in the public about mortgages and jobs and children's futures, all the things that I'm concerned about, especially since losing the primary. So we're all concerned about all those things, and that's mostly, I guess, the environment that got me tossed out. But the most enduring heresy that I'd committed, and really I did commit several heresies, like voting to disapprove of Joe Wilson's outburst or voting against the troop surge in Iraq. But the main heresy, really, was saying that climate change is real and let's do something about it. By the way, what I would do about it is something different than cap and trade. I've got a proposal for a revenue-neutral carbon tax. It's a 15-page alternative to the 1,200-page cap-and-trade. It's a very simple, very transparent, border-adjustable tax that's removed on export, imposed on import, and that it gets us action on climate change, but also makes it so free enterprise can solve this problem by causing the recognition of currently unrecognized negative externalities. That's what's wrong right now, is that coal and petroleum get all these freebies in the air. In the case of petroleum, national security protection, or in other words, the protection of our armed forces, essentially, in delivering that supply line. But if you factored all those things in and eliminated the negative externalities or forced their recognition, then free enterprise could deliver lots of alternative solutions, and we'd be creating jobs and cleaning up the air and improving the national security of the United States. So seen properly, this is a tremendous opportunity for the U.S.
Hmm. But this kind of talk, you think, came across as, you call it heresy there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's received orthodoxy at the moment is, you know, to just say that climate change is a bunch of hooey, we don't need to do anything. If you come along and you say, no, it's a matter of stewardship, let's take action here. Let's take action in a way that actually creates economic opportunity and improves the national security of the United States. You say that, you know, people unfortunately way too many Republicans are looking at me like I'd grown an extra head or something.
And you think this is what cost you your seat?
I think that it's the most enduring heresy. I mean, another one was TARP. You know, I voted against, I voted for TARP. And,
the bailout. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But so all those things created a weakness. But the main thing that seemed to really be sticking in the craw of many primary voters was proposing action on climate change.
Why is that, do you think, that this has become such a dominant theme of a lot of Republican candidates this year, not just rejecting a particular approach to climate change, say, being against cap and trade, but rejecting the very reality?
Well, I think for some people it's really sort of a matter of faith. Many have told me, you know, that it's God's province to determine the length of the earth, and human beings will not affect that. And my answer has been, well, yes, I agree with that, but I also believe that we are empowered as stewards over this wonderful creation. So shouldn't it be that we should take reasonable action as stewards? But that's not what many want to hear. What they want to hear is that we just don't need to worry about that. I think there's also something else that goes along with that, and that is when you tell Americans that we're oil wimps, they just don't want to hear that. We're not used to hearing that we're wimpy, but we are wimps when it comes to oil. We have 3% of the world's proven oil reserves. OPEC has 70% of the world's proven oil reserves. And so when you say to Americans, Republicans or Democrats, independents, all of them, if you say to them, listen, you're an oil wimp, but you're an innovation giant. Now, play to your strengths. Some will pick up on that and say, yeah, we can play to our strengths. We can innovate out of this. Others say, no, you can't call me an oil wimp. And so at some point we can get through that emotional reaction, no, don't call me an oil wimp, and we're going to get to the place of seeing, oh, okay, so we've got a challenge. How are we going to get out of this? How are we going to address this challenge? We're going to address it by innovating, which is our strength.
You changed your mind about this when you were confronted with the facts. You accepted the reality of science there,
right.
but in political science terms, you'd have been better off if you'd have still poo-pooed climate change, wouldn't you?
Oh, it would have been much better if I just continued to say, even in the face of the evidence, that it's all a figment of the imagination of some environmentalist. But, you know, we spend about $340 million a year on the U.S. polar programs, and so when you're on the science committee and you have the opportunity to go visit with the money and to see the research that's being done, you would think that you want to pay attention to the research. We paid for it. We spent a lot of money on it. You would think that we'd want to look at the evidence, see the ice core drillings, see the record of the Earth's atmosphere and the levels of CO2, see how they've risen since the Industrial Revolution, understand that correlation is not causation, but it does stand to reason that if you, since the Industrial Revolution, start introducing fossil fuels long since gone from this atmosphere, burning them in this current atmosphere, this can affect the chemistry of the air now. And so you put all that together and you say, gee, let's see how we can take action. Important that action not destroy the American economy. Because if we export productive capacity from here to places that are going to belch and burn for free, China or India, we haven't done anything. But if we can come up with a system, and this is a revenue-neutral carbon tax, if we can come up with a system that imposes that tax on import, removes it on export, then we muscle China and India into compliance and clean up the air, improve the national security of the United States, and create jobs here.
Here we are talking on election eve. If on election day the candidates who deny that climate change is real or happening or caused by people, if they prevail within your party, what does that tell us about where the Republican Party is heading?
Well, I think that this is a temporary departure, as I say. I think that we will come back to Teddy Roosevelt conservatism, which is that we are also conservationist. We conserve things. So I think this is going to be a temporary departure from that, and that we will eventually come back to real conservatism rather than pseudo-conservatism. Seems to me it really is pseudo-conservatism to say that it doesn't matter how much you belch and burn. It seems to me that it does matter, and that conservatives are also conservationists who say, listen, let's just burn it up. Let's conserve what we've got and figure out best uses of it. You know, there are a lot better things to do with petroleum than burn it. We can make things out of that stuff. And we've got plenty for that. If we could just figure out a way to repower our cars, and we can, if we just unleash the power of free enterprise to solve it by causing the recognition of the currently unrecognized negative externalities associated with petroleum and, in the case of electricity, with coal.
I've heard talk that several people poised to get gavels, that is, to get control of important committees if the Republicans take control of the House, that they plan to use those committees as a forum to bring climate scientists up there and give them a hard time about certain emails in the so-called ClimateGate affair, to go after the EPA's authority to regulate CO2 emissions, things like that. What do you think of that approach?
Well, I think the scientists can take the heat, that's good to ask questions of scientists. What's not good is to leap to unfounded conclusions based on accusations. So, for example, in the case of the emails of ClimateGate, we really shouldn't conclude from that therefore all climate scientists are discredited. There were some clear mistakes in hiding data there. That's not the proper scientific method, and should not have been done. But that doesn't mean that all climate scientists are involved in some sort of hoax or conspiracy. And to go to that conclusion is way overstating the case.
You sound like an eminently reasonable man, and it sounds like that's what ended up costing you your job. I mean, what is the political message of the Bob Inglis story here? Isn't it to reject reality in a way to be successful?
Well, unfortunately, right now people want there's an appetite for scapegoats more than solutions, and so if you go around talking about solutions rather than the emotional scapegoats. In other words, say, here's what, it's all their fault. It's somebody else's fault. Let's blame it on them. Let's have a scapegoat. That works politically right now. But I'm here to predict that eventually America returns to the can-do nation that it is, and it's looking for people with solutions. Because at the end of all that scapegoat hunting, all you do is end up with some people with their heads chopped off. And blood running in the streets, like the French Revolution, and you haven't created anything. America is a place that wants solutions and is typically a can-do place. Right now, we're frightened and frustrated with the economy, understandably so. But we'll get back to being can-do America that solves problems and doesn't just offer up scapegoats.
Representative Bob Inglis of South Carolina's 4th Congressional District, thank you very much.
Great to be with you, Jeff.